One of the most acclaimed great American novels is The Great Gatsby, authored by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The story takes place during the Roaring Twenties, a time of opulent prosperity following World War I. Some have considered this to be the second best English novel of the 20th century, second only to Ulysses, but it's filled with the same depravity and disappointment that's found in Ecclesiastes, for it follows really the same quest. The book is narrated by a character called Nick Carraway, who traces the lavish and dissatisfied life of Jay Gatsby, thus The Great Gatsby. Nick describes Gatsby's chasing of the wind with the following summary. Listen to this. Gatsby believed in the green light, the exciting future that year after year recedes before us. It eludes us then, but that's no matter. Tomorrow we'll run faster, stretch out our arms further, and one fine morning, the line stops. The last line of the book sadly reveals that too often there is no fine morning. Here's the last line of the book. So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. What is so striking about Fitzgerald's depiction of life's elusiveness in his novel is that all of his main characters are people of luxurious wealth. The whole setting is concentrated around two locations called West Egg and East Egg. And both are places of opulence, but I think it's West Egg are the people that have old wealth. They've grown up in families, and they have a history and a tradition of wealth. And East Egg are all these people that have recently come into wealth. And so it's these two communities, both of which are just lavishly rich. And he depicts Jay Gatsby's rival, Tom, as enormously wealthy, and then describes Tom this way. Tom left Chicago and came east in a fashion that rather took your breath away. For instance, he brought down a string of polo phonies from Lake Forest. It was hard to believe that a man in my own generation was wealthy enough to do that. Why they came east, I don't know. They'd spent a year in France for no particular reason and then drifted here and there, unrestfully, wherever people played polo and where they were rich together. Elsewhere, they're described in this way. They were careless people, Tom and Daisy. They smashed up things and creatures and then retreated back into their money or their vast carelessness or whatever it was that kept them together, and let other people clean up the mess they had made. Indeed, there's nothing new under the sun. Fitzgerald simply writes about the same disappointments of wealth that our teacher Solomon discovered 3,000 years ago. Wealth and wistfulness. Riches and ruin. Luxury and loss. Money and meaninglessness. In fact, the Great Gatsby dies the victim of a jealous murder-suicide. And we read these two books together, we're drawn to ask what Jesus would say. For what shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? So in our study through this book so far, we're exploring the darkness, considering this theme that life merely lived under the sun is futile. And as we turn to chapter 5, verses 8 through 20, we discover that that life under the sun worldview is not redeemed by dollar signs either. Today, we take a field trip to Hollywood, Manhattan, Wall Street, or even Geist, and witness the great disappointments of wealth. We're going to be simple this morning and hopefully true to the passage as we consider two points. First, the disappointment of wealth. Let's just trace it. How do we know? How can we be convinced through others' experience, not having to learn firsthand, that wealth is indeed disappointing? Look with me, if you would, at chapter 5, verse 8. We'll read two verses and we'll consider this first idea of extortion. Extortion. If you see the oppression of the poor, the denial of justice and righteousness in the province, don't be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over the other official, and there's a higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. In verses 8 through 9, we see extortion. Solomon refers to the oppression of the poor, the violent perverting of justice and judgment in a province. That word oppression, also that phrase violent perverting, is used throughout the Old Testament to refer to two ideas, the general sense of oppression and a more specific sense of extortion. And oftentimes those two words, violent perverting and oppression, are used in the same context almost to speak to the one and then to the other. People are being oppressed, and specifically they're being oppressed in this way. They're being extorted. Now, we could just trace in verses 8 through 20, and perhaps as I'm talking, you can kind of just let your eyes scan through there, and you'll see reference after reference after reference to riches and to money and to wealth and prosperity. This is a context that's dealing with these financial realities. And so, in keeping with the contents, with the context rather, we are dealing not just with a general oppression, but with a specific extortion here. People are applying their pressure and their power to rob people of what is rightfully theirs. If you just Google extortion stories, you will soon find your mind reeling and your stomach churning at some of the awful and brutal instances of extortion that permeate our society. These are all actual articles that I've read this past week. A computer service technician, two of them actually, who swindled $20 million from a customer who they convinced had been hacked by foreign nationals. That was one that we rather laughed at. But then I read another one where I read of a rabbi who bribed young children to falsely accuse another rabbi of abuse and then attempted to extort $400,000 from that rabbi's family in exchange for leveraging the witnesses. And then I read, really to my horror, of prison cells that have organized themselves to kidnap fellow prisoners in the secrecy of the jail somewhere, sending text messages to that person's family of the brutality that they've already inflicted, promising to do more if payment wasn't given immediately. And that has become a regular enough of occurrence where it's really generated some interest on people's parts. Athletes are regularly extorted. In fact, there are currently over 10,000 federal inmates serving time for doing exactly that. Referring back to the athletes for a minute, perhaps you can remember even this past year, Robert Griffith III. No sooner had he entered the NFL than there was a story coming out where some of his fellow classmates at Baylor were trying to extort him. And it ended up being totally something that, that was non-existent, but that becomes a regularity in our culture. So Solomon, that's why he says, don't be shocked at it, because 3,000 years later, we're still seeing it, and it's all around us. Marvel not at the matter, he says. Why? Because what goes around comes around. Do you see that there in verse 9? So this official is extorting the people under them. Don't worry, because this official has an official over him that's probably doing the same to him, and so on and so forth. And verse 9 is variously translated, but it seems to really show that this chain, what goes around, comes around, goes all the way to the top. It seems to show that this bitter oppression is rampant and widespread, and that this cycle of extortion can be tracked all the way to the top. And so here's how I would suggest we translate that verse 9. The produce of the land is seized by all of them. Even the king is served by the fields. We can go to the highest levels of justice, and there we see perverted oppression. Now, in verse 8, if we remember what Solomon wrote in chapter 3, verse 17, I'll read it for you. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked, for a time for every matter and every deed is there. Now, if we keep chapter 3, verse 17 in mind, when we read verse 8, what should we also be reminded of when it comes to the extortioner? What goes around comes around. Don't worry, because this oppressor, this extortioner's got another one above him and another one above him and another one above him. How should our Christian worldview continue and flesh that out? Dan?
His day will come.
Yeah, his day will come. Why? Because who stands at the top of all of it? There is a judge at the top of all. And while he will not oppress unfairly, he will oppress all those who have unfairly oppressed. And so hope even glimmers through as we apply a Christian worldview to what we read there in verses 8 and 9. Extortion, we see it all around us. We pick up the newspaper. We see it over and over and over again. Wealth is disappointing. Number two, there is a general disillusionment to wealth. Just a general disillusionment to wealth. Marilyn Monroe once said, dreaming about being an actress is more exciting than being one. And so it seems like Solomon would take that and change it and say this, the idea of being wealthy is actually more exciting than being wealthy. Wealth is disappointing because of the disillusionment of materialism. Look at verse 10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with its income. Oh, how deceptive money is. And nobody seems to believe this proverb until they're living it. Someone asked John D. Rockefeller, how much money does it take to satisfy a man? Rockefeller's reply, just a little bit more than he has. In the 1960s musical Cabaret, we were told that money makes the world go round. And many people have believed that lie until they discovered that the second law, or that the law of diminishing returns, rather, is true not only in the workings of economics, but also in the rewards of economics. And no sooner do I have, than I want more. And no sooner do I have that, then I need more. And wherever I'm at, I'm not satisfied because the returns and the rewards seem oh so diminishing. There's such a sense of disillusionment. How frequently the legend of King Midas is lived out in today's world. People worship gold and find it increasing with their workaholic touch. But they eventually discover that it takes away everything truly meaningful to them. And with Solomon, they conclude, as does verse 10, this also is vanity. The hungriest of materialistic hearts, the richest of covetous aristocrats have all discovered that money does not satisfy. Speak to me for a bit here. How have you witnessed or discovered the disillusionment of material gain, money, stuff? How have you seen that disillusionment? How have you experienced that disillusionment?
Maybe the more stuff I have, like, you could lose it. Car, you might not drive in certain areas because you're afraid, you know, or you might park out farther than parking.
Sure, right,
that.
Right.
Or, like, if you have a lot of things in your house, you'd probably be more tempted to, you know, if you have a big house, you'd probably spend more time cleaning that or something like that.
Sure,
than,
sure,
you know,
okay. Yeah, sure, great. Don.
I just know for myself, like, as far as clothing, being really excited about getting maybe a certain top or something and then wearing it for 3 times and then feeling like,
yeah, sure. Yeah. Yep. True to life in American culture. Yeah. Dan. Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Proverbs says so much about that. Quick money. Yeah, Liz.
I'm just thinking of the show Hoarders.
I've not seen that.
You
have
it?
No.
No.
Don't.
Do you know what
too
it
much
is?
Of this? No.
It's basically they go to people's homes. They have so much of everything.
Oh.
Like their house is full of just stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, I won't watch it because that'll.
Yeah, that's good.
I'm OCD about stuff like that, so I don't want anybody set off. For me, I think I've experienced it here. I've had this October. I can't wait. But October, my contract is up so that I can get a new one of these. And this is the first time I've had an iPhone. And you know, you don't have an iPhone, you don't have a smartphone or anything like that, and you just live without it. And then you get it, and you find all its possibilities, and you maximize it to the core in so much that it's slow, and it ticks me off. And I can't wait till I can get the next one, right? There's stuff, there's materials that I have gotten that I was so glad, and I'm still glad for it. But it comes down to what's your focus, it comes down to where's your heart. And it still is a tool that I value, but sometimes when I put too much on it, it becomes a source of frustration, a source of bitterness, and a source that reminds me that there is only disillusionment there. Got another discussion that we'll save for the website this next week, so let's move on to number 3. The discussion question you'll see on the website is, what counsel does Jesus provide in Luke 16 regarding how to receive true satisfaction from physical wealth? In the economy of God, physical wealth can give satisfaction, but only when entered into in the fear of God rather than merely under the sun. Jesus talks about that in Luke 16. We'll talk about it on the web this next week. Number 3, here's a great term for us, one that I don't think I've ever used in a setting like this. Number 3, another manifestation of the disappointment of wealth is moochers. Moochers. I really tried to come up with a better sounding word. Nothing connected with me as well as that did. Verse 11, when good things increase, so do those who consume them. So what advantage to their owners except to look on? One very practical reason why money fails to deliver on its promises is given here. As soon as our money increases, so do our friends. What taxes don't immediately eat away, that's the term he uses here, friends make. No sooner do we have a lucrative job or receive our hard-earned rewards, Then parasitic moocher showed up with seemingly sincere congratulations, masking their self-centered appetites. Solomon had apparently seen this too often before. Proverbs 14:20, the poor is hated of even his neighbor, but the rich hath many friends. Proverbs 19:4, wealth maketh many friends, but the poor is separated from his neighbor. Proverbs 19:6, many will entreat the favor of the prince, and every man is a friend of him that giveth gifts. That's why we love Santa Claus. Well, research statistics tell us that over 75% of NFL players, are bankrupt or financially stressed 2 years after their retirement. That is astounding. While financial naivety certainly plays its part in these sad stories, so do mooching friends who last only as long as the money does. And just Google it, and you'll see plenty of articles toward that end. So for these wealthy or formerly wealthy individuals, these owners in the text, what advantage, what good does their wealth give them? Solomon offers an answer at which we would laugh if it weren't so sad. These miserable misers only have gained this, their meaningless, quote, beholding of their riches with their eyes. They get to look at it, and they get to watch it diminish. Number four, stress. Extortion, disillusionment, moochers, and now stress, verse 12. The sleep of the working man is pleasant, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich man does not allow him to sleep. Even that glance that he speaks about at the end of verse 11, all they get to do is behold with their eyes their riches. Even that glance is dissatisfying. For instead of providing happiness in what he's earned, verse 12, it brings stress over what might be lost. Solomon writes, the sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much. For he's mastered the wisdom of chapter 4, verse 6. Remember that? Better is one hand with peace rather than two hands full of striving after wind. He's learned to be content with working hard but modestly so that he might enjoy better things in life. Thus, while the rich find their wealth, and get some of the wordplay that Solomon is incorporating here, while the rich find their wealth eaten by others, previous verse, the laboring man is content with little or much, for he is eating what he himself has earned. So the rich find their stuff eaten away by others, but the hard-working, modest man is able to eat and enjoy his own. On the contrary, he who determines to find fulfillment in material gain soon learns the irony that his abundance will not allow him to sleep. The anxieties of the man of money drive him to sleeping pills and tranquilizers. And what is at the root of such endless stress? It's the fifth aspect of wealth's disappointment, the possibility of losing it all, loss. In verses 13 through 17, rather than reading it, maybe you can let your eyes traverse those verses and we'll follow the progress. He speaks here of a sore evil under the sun. He loves that phrase. He's used it several times in Ecclesiastes already. This sore travail, this bitter business. This is what I've seen, verse 13. A fellow who amasses and hoards great riches, but is paid dearly for it. You see that word hurt in verse 13. This hurt may be moral decadence following ill-gotten gain, or more true to the context, maybe it just simply refers to the hurt of verse 12, this physical deterioration following sleepless nights. Whatever it is, he's paid for it, but he's gotten it. Verse 14, then due to an evil travail, and that phrase is used throughout Scripture to refer either to bad luck or to a bad business venture. So either he made a really bad mistake and he lost it all, or life struck. And all of a sudden, he loses everything. Apparently, according to verse 14, this even happened at the worst of times, for a baby boy had just been born to this now destitute man, and he had nothing to pass on to him. No inheritance, but no provision either. So verse 15, the individual is faced with the stark reality that he will indeed die just as he was born, naked and unable to take anything of his labor which he may carry away in his hand. So in verses 16 through 17, Solomon asks how he fared in this quest to find satisfaction with his wealth. What profit hath he? Solomon asks. And in his depiction of that quest as merely laboring for the wind, we learn that he both grasped at nothing and received exactly what he was grasping at. Nothing. His life's pursuit is summarized by one word, darkness, the details of which are just as gloomy: sorrow, wrath, and sickness. And all of that is included there for you in verses 16 and 17. So what we're discovering here then is that the loss is not just financial, but it's also familial and physiological. He has lost both possessions and peace. He's destroyed both his health and his home. He's forfeited everything. Ironic, his material pursuits under the sun have left him in complete darkness. Don't go there, Solomon is saying. Don't rely on money to give you meaning. Don't rely on finances to give you fulfillment. There is only disillusionment, extortion, bitterness, and eventually loss there. So learn from the teacher and put no confidence in money and materialism. Remind yourself of these five disappointments summarized so well by verse 10. He that loveth money shall not be satisfied with money, nor he that loveth wealth with increase. This also is vanity. Now, as we transition into our second point, we've got to think and we've got to apply some logic here and probably some questions that maybe are arising in your own mind. A problem should arise here. We all of necessity will interact with money, for on one level, money does make the world go round. It pays our bills, it provides for our needs, etc. So it seems then that as we traverse the difficult road here between the love of money on the one side and the need for money on the other. And so far we've been helped to recognize that I shouldn't fall into the ditch of the love of money. But I still need it to take care of life. So how does a wise individual traverse this terrain? Well, like he did in chapter 2, verses 24 through 27, Solomon again briefly pulls back the curtain a bit to reveal the light. Having considered one way to live under the sun, he also discusses its alternative now in verse 18, living in the fear of God. So we turn our attention to verses 18 through 20. Having considered the dark disappointments of wealth, now we consider the brilliant economy of God. Now, before we consider the plans of God in these verses, we first need to issue a little caveat, a little warning. Do not interpret these verses, verses 18 through 20, that paragraph there. Do not interpret this passage as providing financial guidance or strategies for financial security. It's not Solomon's point. This passage was not intended to be a workshop on how to handle your money. Instead, it serves as a pre-workshop, as a philosophy of wealth that must undergird any application of specific principles. Okay, to state it more relevantly, this passage is not a Dave Ramsey seminar. It's not intended to give us principles about getting out of debt, saving for the future, planning wisely for the unknowns, preparing for retirement, or determining a good budget. Instead, this is the overarching counsel of God for people who are seeking for satisfaction from Him and wondering how that relates to their money. Additional wisdom from God will be necessary as we flesh out this financial philosophy. With that said, let's trace three truths discovered in God's economy. And appropriately, we'll even use a banking illustration to help us along the way. Number one, here's God's economy. You, friend, can make a withdrawal. You can make a withdrawal. Look at verse 18. Behold, that which I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun, all the days of his life which God hath given him, for it is his portion. Inspired by God, Solomon encourages us to enjoy the life that God has given us. And in this context, to enjoy the material profits that we received from our labor. God encourages us to make a withdrawal from our bank account of life and to spend it enjoyably. Indeed, this is our good and fitting portion. That word fitting is the same word he used in chapter 3, verse 11, where he says, God has made everything fitting in its time. And now God is saying here, hey, here's one of these fitting things that you enjoy what God has allowed you to earn. He says it's our portion, graciously given to us by the God who is our portion. How many times does the Old Testament say that? God is your portion. And now that God is saying, and here's your portion. So what we are learning here is that the enjoyment of life's earnings are a part of pleasures forevermore and fullness of joy discovered at God's right hand. When was the last time somebody said that to you? Do you get that? Let me say it again. What we're learning here is that the enjoyment of life's earnings are a part of pleasures forevermore and fullness of joy discovered at God's right hand and allotted to us as a part of his beautiful and appropriate plan. That's exactly what this passage is saying. God is telling you, make a withdrawal because that's your portion in life. Now, with our previously stated qualifier in mind, we need to remind ourselves again that this does not relieve us from the necessary virtues and disciplines of contentment, responsibility, integrity, prayer, and thanksgiving when we withdraw enjoyment. Okay, all of those things are necessary. And so he's going to write another book, Proverbs, on how to be wise when you enjoy the enjoyment principle. This passage doesn't excuse us from making deposits. We still need to make deposits to that bank account and work hard. On the contrary, Solomon encourages us to enjoy the good of all our labor twice. So we're not being excused from making deposits, from working hard, from producing fruit that we can enjoy. But we also can't overlook the fact that he does tell us to enjoy that fruit. So leaving some other discussion for our website, let's hasten to number 2 so we can bring it together in number 3. Number 1, we can make a withdrawal. Why? It's number 2. God has made a deposit. And do you see the connection there between verses 18 and 19? Everything we just read in verse 18, now why? Every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also given him the power or ability to eat thereof and to accept his portion and rejoice in his labor. It is the gift of God. Beautiful, right? It's so crystal clear. God has given you not only the fruit of your labor, but he's given you the ability to enjoy it. So because God has deposited to your bank account of life, you withdraw. Yes, with wisdom. Yes, with worship. Yes, with thanksgiving. But withdraw. It's a part of pleasures forevermore and fullness of joy that God has promised at his right hand. So in the context of living in the fear of God, it's all beginning to make sense. Now, we always question, right? When I'm dealing with withdrawals and deposit, what's the bottom line going to look like? What's the balance going to look like? Number 3, the balance will be joy. The balance will be joy. Look at verse 20. For he, that's the individual being talked about here, hopefully you and me, for you and I shall not much remember or dwell on the fleeting days of life. Why? Because God answereth him, kind of a bad translation, God keeps him preoccupied with the joy of his heart. See, in God's economy, loss is not even a factor. Disillusionment is not even a reality. In God's economy, he's given you today for you to enjoy. And as with wisdom and with worship and with integrity and with prayer and contentment and joy, as you withdraw what God has deposited, he's guaranteed you'll never be frustrated with the fleeting nature of life. Instead, I am going to preoccupy your heart with joy. A tremendous passage. Our field trip among the mansions, fashion malls, opulent parties has taught us that true significance and fulfillment is not discovered there. Instead, in the fear of God, it's found in your small 2-bedroom, 1.5-bath ranch home in the neighborhoods of Nora. Why? Because that's God's gift to you. And grateful contentment is the starting point of lasting joy. Let's pray. God, we're young and we're just starting out with this whole career thing. Help us to understand the pre-workshop. Help us understand the message that you've given to us this morning. May we be content with the deposits that you've given, with wisdom and worship. May we enjoy those things, and may we experience the joy, the everlasting joy at your right hand that you've promised. Thank you for how you've worked all these things out in our minds today, and may we continue to meditate on them throughout the week. God, we go to worship you now. May we do it in spirit and with truth. May you be pleased to see hearts and wills and minds and thoughts and emotions engaged in the pursuit of your Son this morning. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.